propaganda.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I am Sharon Gilbert, everybody. And welcome to April the 22nd of 2007. What a week.
This has been a week that none of us will forget for a long, long time, especially here in Columbia. Was a little known footnote to the events that took place Monday at Virginia Tech University, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, but we will have to get into what happened at Virginia Tech. Blacksburg, Virginia was the scene of, well, just mind-numbing carnage last Monday.
And before we get into anything, we want to express our deepest condolences to any of our listeners who know someone, have a family member, or in any way you feel touched personally by the Virginia Tech shootings. This was a very dark day in American history, and as you're going to hear us talk about in the next hour or so, we believe that there are forces behind it that go way beyond the shooter.
Right. The natural reaction to some of the things that we'll say is likely to be, oh, come on, this could not possibly have been planned out in advance. However, we remind you that when we peer into darkness, we're looking at the supernatural forces that we believe are moving the chess pieces on the board that we call life on planet Earth.
Yeah, and it's more than just looking and naturally doubting everything you hear. And I know I get accused of that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Well, you throw water on everything. You doubt everything. Well, you know, as a rule, I take very little at face value. And that's simply from personal experience. But Derek and I have learned a lot about that darkness over the last few years. And there are pieces to the puzzle, aspects to the supernatural battle that really have come into play during the last week.
Of course, you know that 32 students were killed, and then the purported gunman, Cho Sung-hee, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name exactly correctly, but the details that have come out over the last week have left us scratching our heads at a few things. First of all, and I hate to say that I was so cynical, but when the news reports first came out, and you told me what was going on, I called you late morning that day, not really aware of what was going on.
About the Columbia event, and no, it was something else.
The Columbia event was on Wednesday.
That's right, there was on Wednesday.
About something else, and I was not really aware of what was going on, but you very quickly filled me in and said there were 31 dead.
25, actually, at that point.
Okay, on the Virginia Tech campus.
20 or 25, and of course, that number went up.
Yeah, my reaction was, what do you bet we wind up with a final death count of 33?
Mm-hmm. I know, sadly, that was mine as well.
Yeah, and it turns out that that was the final death toll. And you've heard us talk before about the number 33 and certain occult implications that are connected to that number. Again, reaction, how could he possibly have planned it out? He shot some people who survived. Well, if you assume that all of this was the work of man and man alone, then I would agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
The odds of him planning for a total death count of 33, slim to none. But somewhere we suspect that there are supernatural forces, dark angels that are laughing.
Mm-hmm.
At the signal that was sent.
We were also told by the surgeons who had to take care of many, many victims. Many survived. There were a number of young men and women who survived, praise God. But they were giving a press conference with regard to the deceased and made the statement, each person was shot three times. Now, we've got the number 33, and then we've got the number 3. It's almost like someone is winking and saying, for those in the know, this was a black op.
The killer, also 23 years old. We just had the Jim Carrey movie released recently, the number 23. Why is that significant? You know, two-thirds, two divided by three is 666. Why is 33 significant? Because it implies one third the number of the angels that rebelled against God, and you know other other things. One of the
also his room number was 2121.
2121, right? Which is you know two twos and two ones, or 33 if you want to add the numbers together again. So there are a lot of occult traces around this. We don't know that he was dabbling in the occult. We don't know the significance of the name that he wrote on the inside of his left arm and read Ismail X.
If you have been on vacation and you've not kept up, or if you simply don't care to keep up, we have a few listeners who write to me and say, honestly, I just get my news from you because I don't want to watch television. I don't want to read these things. Ismail is male hyphen X A X. It was not Ishmael. It was not Ismail as M A E L. It was M A I L. It was a very unusual spelling of it. One would think as an English major that he would have known how to spell Ishmael.
Yeah, although that's not an unheard of spelling. A couple of very prominent professional football players of recent years, Rocket Ismail and Raghib Ismail, spelled the same way.
That's a good point. If anyone is taking this was scrawled inside his arm, inside his elbow, with red ink, and those who do mention it at all on the mainstream media are connecting it to Islam activity, to ratchet up the possibility that somehow he was involved in a jihad-type event. I don't think personally that makes any sense, because if you look at his video, he's comparing himself to Jesus Christ.
Right. You crucify me like Jesus Christ. That is not something that
a Muslim would do that.
Not a true believing Muslim, no.
No.
So that is a little bit curious. We've not deciphered that, and we're certainly open to discussion as to what that. We even went to a couple of websites on the internet that have anagram solvers and tried to see if there were some hidden meanings in the letters if you shuffled them around in different ways.
Yeah, we couldn't find one. Doesn't mean that it isn't there. There's a story that I posted at CTD, a photograph and a blog entry that I found from a person in Indonesia who met someone that looks remarkably like Cho Sung-hui, and he called himself Ismail, and the blogger said his real name was Song Hu or Song Ho or something like that. Last name Cho. Those names are almost identical to Cho Sung-hui, and the person who wrote the blog said, when I asked him his name, he said, Indonesian people don't pronounce it right. Just call me Ismail. And it was spelled exactly the same way, I-S-M-A-I-L. Again, there's a photograph of this young man. He looks very much like Cho Sung-hui. And I've got that picture. I've got the Indonesian blog entry. I've received sort of a rough draft translation from one of our listeners' friends, and that translation makes it clear that this person who called himself Ismail over in Indonesia was translating for Korean friends. We have not at all heard from the mainstream media anything about the shooter at Virginia Tech, Cho, being someone who traveled abroad recently. The date on this picture is July of 2006.
Yeah.
Indonesia is an extremely, it's. I think they have more Muslims per capita there than any other country.
Well, Indonesia is a very large country. People forget how big it is.
It's huge.
More Muslims in Indonesia than in most of the
nations. Well, more per capita, the percentage of the population that is Muslim is higher than any other country, from what I have read. Now, you're looking at me like I...
You're probably right about that. But then when you add the just total number of people there, there's just a whole lot of Muslims in Indonesia.
And there have been, strangely enough, there have been stories of crucifixions, crucifying Christians out of Indonesia, a lot of persecution of Christianity in Indonesia. It seems very odd that the mainstream media wouldn't have somehow picked up on this. Within hours of my finding that site and posting that blog, it disappeared.
So that has been archived, and you can find that at the Connecting the Dots website, which is peeringintodarkness.com/CTD.
Yeah.
Another few little bits of information that we discovered. One of the things that the major media has been talking about in reporting the manifesto that he delivered to NBC News was his rant against rich kids, debauchery.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do a little background into Cho's family history, we find that his relatives in Seoul, Korea, said that they left Korea in 1992 with practically nothing, had to scrape up together every available resource in order to
get onto the plane. And that's what the mainstream media keeps going on and on about, how they didn't have a whole lot of money.
They didn't have a whole lot of money. Now, they live in a relatively well-off area of Washington, D.C., which is not a cheap place to live.
Fairfax County, Virginia. Yeah. Very expensive area to live.
And it turns out that Cho's older sister graduated from Princeton in 2004. Princeton is a very expensive place to go to school.
Oh, at least $50,000 a year. They arrived here in 1992. The Immigration Service said that they arrived in Detroit. We know from the family back in South Korea that they barely were able to scrape together enough to buy the tickets.
Mm-hmm.
So they arrived in Detroit. Shortly after arriving here, Cho Sung-hui was taken to a doctor because he had not talked. He very rarely spoke anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was 8 years old, and he was diagnosed as autistic.
Yeah.
You're not hearing the mainstream media talking about that. And I want to, before I go any further with that, I want to emphasize, it is not the autism that caused his outburst.
No.
That is not a direct correlation. I bring it up because I find it ridiculous that the medical records could have that he was diagnosed with autism, and it's never mentioned. And the school seemed to just sort of take it at autistic behavior. Very bright people, men and women who are autistic, they don't relate well in social situations.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, they don't talk. And this is something that should have been considered rather than having his friends think of him as, oh, he's stuck up, he is a misfit, he's this or that. The school should have been aware that he was autistic.
Yeah. The other piece of this puzzle that...
Oh, no, we need to continue
with
the fact that they arrived in Detroit. And within, from 1992, 8 years went by. Only 8 years.
Right, after arriving penniless, practically.
Practically penniless, which amazes me that they were able to get over here, because I know that there is a... what is the legal term? You have to show that you can support yourself. There's a legal term to it before you can be admitted.
Need a sponsor or something, yeah.
Yeah. They have a home in a wealthy neighborhood, a neighborhood that the townhome that they lived in is selling on Realtor.com for around $300,000, one like it.
Mm-hmm.
They have managed in the year 2000 to have enough money that they can send their daughter to Princeton.
Right. And then just a year or two later, put their son, after she graduates, their son is in Virginia Tech, which, again, is not a, no matter what college you send your kid to, it's not a cheap proposition.
No.
But, yeah, Princeton is very expensive. And following that, then, the older sister, Sun Kyung Cho, was employed upon graduation by a company called McNeil Technologies. McNeil Technologies, and this, and everything we're reporting here, this is not internet rumor or blog posts or things. These are coming from major media sources.
Right.
Lots of little data points scattered out there like corn for chickens to peck up, but nobody's scooping it together and baking it into a loaf of bread.
Honey.
Yeah, that's a metaphor. So Sun Kyung Cho graduates from Princeton in 2004. She goes to work for McNeil Technologies, which is a government contractor employed by the U.S. Department of State to help rebuild Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
McNeil Technologies was purchased a couple of years ago by a venture capital firm called Veritas Capital. Now, Veritas Capital has, among its advisory council members, Richard Armitage, the guy who admits to outing Valerie Plame, also former bigwig inside the State Department, Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
General Barry McCaffrey, he was the drug czar during in the Clinton administration. And General Anthony Zinni, who was the head of U.S. military operations in the Mideast during the Clinton administration, went back as a special envoy to the Mideast for President Bush. Other companies owned by Veritas Capital include MZM, which is now known as Athena Innovative Solutions. MZM is the company whose founder was offering special bribes and incentives to California Representative Duke Cunningham in that scandal. They've since changed names now. It's Athena.
Mm-hmm.
And DynCorp International.
DynCorp.
DynCorp has been accused by former employees of sex trafficking in Bosnia and by a special investigative general of defrauding the U.S. government of millions of dollars in Iraq. So now, again, the activities of Athena Innovative Solutions or and DynCorp have, in all likelihood, nothing at all to do with what happened at Virginia Tech last Monday.
Right.
But what it might indicate is that the Cho family, rather than arriving in the U.S. penniless, might be a little better connected than we've been led to believe.
They might be, and I think that there's one aspect of their life back in South Korea that might be a lead. I'm not saying it's a definite, you know, here's the answer, but it's a lead. You know, as an investigative journalist, you have to follow up on various leads, information. Cho Sung-hui's father was, we don't know what he did precisely, but he worked in Saudi Arabia at least two or three different times.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in Seoul, South Korea. He is 10 years older than Cho's mother. And she was at age 29. Her father and her father and mother, and I think her older brother and sister. I'm sorry. She was the second oldest there. So just her father and mother arranged this blind date with a young man who was 39,
mm-hmm.
and they ended up getting married. Within a very short time, they had their first child. He went back to Saudi Arabia. He was working with construction there. The reason I bring that up is because Saudi Arabia is a very interesting area, and granted, there was a lot of construction going on there at the time. But who did a lot of that construction? A lot of it was done by the Osama bin Laden family.
Mm-hmm.
Saudi Arabia is also a very notorious sponsor of terrorism. There's a lot going on backdoor intelligence gathering with respect to the United States over in all of those countries. It is possible, and again, this is just a lead, so I'm guessing at this point, but it is possible that if there is a connection between the intelligence community and the Cho family, it may have started there.
Yeah, it is entirely possible, and that is something that is beyond our ability to investigate at this point. Other than just, you know, scouring the web to see what other researchers have turned up. There is one other bit of news that we should pass along. This was reported by Paul Joseph Watson, who is the web manager for Alex Jones at his website. He is quoting sources at Virginia Tech as saying that campus police were given a federal order to stand down after the first shooting that took place Monday morning. Now, if you know the timeline, you know there was a shooting at West Ambler Johnston Hall in which two people were killed, a young woman and the resident advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a two-hour gap during which we're told Cho went back to his room, assembled the materials that he sent to NBC, went into Blacksburg, mailed them on a priority overnight package, then went back to campus, collected his guns, his chains, went to Norris Hall, and then began the shooting rampage there at Norris Hall. If, in fact, the campus police and EMTs were told to stand down and wait until federal authorities arrived, it makes one wonder what was going on.
It really does, especially in light of a couple of factors. In August of 2006, last fall, a gunman escaped from the local county courthouse, and it was the first day of school. Virginia Tech campus was locked down. You weren't allowed to get on that campus. They had police everywhere. And they were very much on high alert. It was evacuated. Kids were told to stay in their dorms, away from their windows. and all the dorms were locked. Two times prior to the April 16th shootings, once on April 2nd and again on April 13th, there were bomb threats to the school. You heard early on, I haven't really heard much of it mentioned in the last few days, we heard early on that next to Cho Sung-wee's body was a backpack with the receipt for his weapon.
Yeah,
and
the one that had the serial number filed off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you would think if it's a receipt, it would have his name on it, yet we have no ID, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, we don't know. But there was also supposedly a note that was a bomb threat.
Right.
They were able to compare to the other bomb threat notes.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't called in. They were notes. And you would think after two bomb threats that any activity like that, and again, the background of the August event where they locked down campus, unless the federal authorities or someone came in and said, do not do this, I can't imagine that they would not have locked down that whole campus.
Mm-hmm.
So why wait for two and a half hours to do anything?
Right.
It's very disturbing.
In addition, cell phone service was disrupted after the first event that morning.
We know this for a fact, and you'll find Doug Hagman has been following that lead and trying to determine exactly
right.
what was happening. He, my understanding is, if I understood his article correctly, he is saying that the police believed that there was a possibility that the bomb threat was a reality. They had to go on that assumption, and therefore they could not allow access to a possible detonation of a bomb via a cell phone.
Yeah, and that's an exclusive story. We'll link to the article at HomelandSecurityUS.com, Doug Hagman's website. Cell phones intentionally jammed at Virginia Tech by authorities. People were wondering why students weren't notified by text message or by cell phone. It's because they couldn't.
Right.
They couldn't. So you've got that to consider. The stand down order to consider. And then the other thing to consider, and maybe you're going here, the differing descriptions of the shooter.
Actually, I wasn't, but go ahead and you go with that, and then I'll go with what I was going to say.
Okay. Different descriptions of the shooter. Sharon picked up on this and posted this to CTD. Derek Odell, who was a young man who was shot in the arm, you probably saw him interviewed several times on the cable news channels, said the gunman was wearing a black leather coat and maroon hat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Erin Sheehan, a young lady who was interviewed several times on various cable channels, said Cho dressed sort of strangely, almost like a Boy Scout. Very short-sleeved, light tan shirt and some sort of ammo vest.
Mm-hmm. That's what we saw in the video. He had on the short-sleeved shirt that was a light color, and he had what looked like some sort of vest. No, the shirt was black.
The shirt was black. The
vest
was tan.
That's right. It was the opposite of what she said.
But that's quite a difference from a black leather coat and maroon hat.
Very different. Plus, the original shooter wearing the black leather coat was described as 6 feet tall Asian male.
Yeah.
My understanding is, from the sources I've got, I'm getting that Cho Sung-wee was about 5'8", 5'9".
Yeah. A little bit different there.
A little different.
So we're wondering now. You can say fog of war when you're in fear of your life and scrambling for cover. You may not get a good look or have a clear memory of the person that you saw.
Right.
On the other hand, is it possible? And this is sheer speculation on our part without any evidence other than this, you know, the differing descriptions here. Is it possible that there was a second gunman?
That is exactly what I keep asking. Was there a second gunman? In fact, I saw one source, and that source has since disappeared, so I apologize that I can't find it for you. But I read a source that claimed that, what is his name, Gruel, Karan Gruel, one of the suite mates to Cho Sung-wee, was handcuffed. Right after the 7:15 shooting, they went right over to the dorm next door and found him and handcuffed him. Now, that story may have disappeared because it was untrue. But I find it very interesting that would have happened. This would have been at the time that Cho was supposedly in that same suite.
Mm-hmm. Room 2121.
Ranting and raving, filming his last...
His
accusations,
manifesto,
sure. His manifesto, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
That makes no sense. Also, if Gruhl was there, which he says he was, why didn't he hear this?
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you wonder. Well, it's possible that he did record this all in advance and that everything was prepared. It's possible.
But what the authorities are saying is that the comments he makes, this is, you could have prevented this, this
true.
Is all your fault,
mm-hmm.
has to do with the initial shooting.
So they presume that that took place after mm-hmm. the first shooting. What is also very puzzling about this is, I had a had an idea that I was going to go with here.
I was going to bring up the fact that he was unrecognizable. He had so damaged his face with
yes.
a 22.
Yeah, that's the other
how
thing.
How do you do that?
22 caliber is the handgun of choice for professional assassins, I've read, because when you shoot, it leaves a relatively small entrance hole because it's a small
and
bullet.
And it doesn't exit.
And it doesn't exit because it's not big enough caliber to punch out the other side of the skull, frankly.
Right.
So, 22 caliber is less than a quarter of an inch diameter. And unlike a 45, which is nearly half inch around and causes mm-hmm. significantly more damage, has a lot more, destructive mm-hmm. power when it impacts. But that's two things to consider. Number one, how does he cause that much damage with a small caliber handgun? Number two, how does one turn the gun around? I mean, try doing this with your finger, mm-hmm. Pretending your finger is a pistol. And how difficult is it to get your arm back in that position and pull the trigger?
Right.
And imagine that the handgun is going to be actually longer than your finger.
Mm-hmm.
It would make more sense to put it to your temple and
shoot.
Which is what he did in the video. So we're told that he so disfigured his face that they had to identify him by fingerprint.
Mm-hmm.
We're also told, and this is something that is not often mentioned, although I have seen them bring it up on the cable news channels, from time to time, they have not yet linked him physically to the crime scene at West Ambler Johnston Hall, even though they've linked the gun to the crime scene. They've not yet established that he was at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's presumed because his fingerprints are on the gun, and the gun was found next to him at Norris Hall, but they have yet this little detail that they, I presume they figure it's fait accompli, Well, we've got the gun, we've got the guy, fingerprints are on the gun, gun was mm-hmm. used in this case, so
right.
it's all one and the same.
Right. I have so many questions about this.
Yeah. So what are we saying? Well, frankly, we're just throwing stuff out and just asking questions.
What I'm saying is that it doesn't add up. From very early on, as we said, when the numbers started coming out,
mm-hmm.
I started thinking this seems like, to use Russ Dizdar's phrase, a black awakening event.
Yeah. It does. What are the implications of this? Well, I can tell you that we've talked a lot about on my radio show this week about how the major media is spinning this as regards the availability of handguns. And we'll talk a little bit about why that became a bigger issue after Wednesday here in Columbia. So gun control is one topic, one political football that is now back in play after mm-hmm. what happened Monday. We're also seeing articles that are appearing in the news about how killers have discernible differences in their brains that can be detected. We've also heard, too, about how he fell through the cracks. He'd been determined that he was an imminent danger to himself and to others by a judge in Virginia mm-hmm. a couple of years ago.
I think it said just to self.
Yeah. And he was recommended for treatment or for counseling or at least for evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
But the question then is, why did he fall through the cracks? And how do we prevent the next one from falling through the cracks? Well, if you've listened to PID Radio for a long time, you'll know that we have in the past discussed a recommendation that was made by an advisory commission to the president that all school children in the United States be screened, be given a mental health evaluation so that we can spot these people before mm-hmm. they get old enough to pick up a gun and start shooting.
Exactly, and that's the reason. If what we're saying, if this indeed is an event that was somehow caused to happen, we can't get specific because we don't have tangible connections.
Mm-hmm.
We just have suspicions, to be honest with you. But if let's just hypothesize for a minute. If someone had been using Cho Sen-hui from a very early age as a mind control experiment, a Manchurian candidate, if you will, And for whatever the trigger was, something, some event precipitated this action of his. And I would say that it happened earlier than that morning because friends had said that suddenly, over the last few weeks and days, he had been working out at the gym. He bought the gun 6 weeks prior.
Mm-hmm.
He had been planning this. This was something that was coming up soon, and he knew it. Now, if someone had messed with his mind in a way that caused him to intentionally be a soldier, that you could just push a button and he would go and do his what he had been programmed to do.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, then you have to ask yourself, who benefits from that?
Yeah.
And are there others out there?
Mm-hmm.
That's one aspect of the Black Awakening that Russ Dizdar talks about.
Right. Well, who would benefit? Clearly, people without guns are more easily controlled, more easily cowed.
Well, exactly. We're going to see a lot of legislation.
Right. Also, there are some very large corporate entities that would benefit from opening up a new market of sub-high school age, say elementary through junior high children who may be diagnosed as mentally ill and in need of some
medication.
In need of medication.
And they'll need to be on that medication probably for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. So that is something to consider. Again, it's just, you know, our minds thinking about who might benefit from something like this.
You know, let's just talk about medication for a few minutes, because if you've listened to this for any length of time, you know I have a real pet peeve about this.
Mm-hmm.
I think Americans, possibly everyone in the world, you know, all cultures, but America I know about. I think Americans are over medicating. I really do. I think doctors over prescribe. I don't think that we need nearly the antibiotics that we're taking. We definitely do not need the mind altering, neurophysiological altering drugs that we're taking. We just watched a commercial tonight for a product that has butterfly in it. I won't name it, but you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at Derek and I said, a butterfly. You know, you ever ask yourself why a butterfly might be in an ad for a sleep product?
Mm-hmm.
Monarch.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, technically it's a moth, but I mean the symbolism.
No,
is
it?
You're right. The tail does look an awful lot like a swallowtail butterfly.
It looks like a butterfly, and if you look online and you do a search, you'll see most people think of it as a luminescent butterfly.
As opposed to a moth. Okay.
As opposed to a moth.
Yeah, I'd have to look at that again. But that is interesting. That is a huge, huge market. If you look, I did some research once, just for my own curiosity, at the most profitable industries in the United States, the biggest industries in the U.S., and it won't surprise most listeners, I think, to know that the biggest industries are petroleum, pharmacy, banking, and the defense contractors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, what basically drives most of the big policy decisions in the United States today? Well, banking, military spending, pharmaceuticals, and, you know, and many times they will dovetail with one another. We see that the United States military is being required once again to offer anthrax inoculations, anthrax vaccines to their soldiers, and soldiers are not being allowed to opt out.
And those had some bad side effects, as I remember, cardiovascular side effects.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see an awful lot of legislation come out of this, not just the Virginia Tech shootings,
mm-hmm.
but also legislation with regard to FDA approval of products that go into pet food, human food, because we've had that whole scandal come out over the last few weeks. And again, we have another one coming out today that relates to human consumption, because apparently there were swine in California that were eating rice that was impregnated
with
melamine. And the fear is that anyone who eats that pork may become sick.
Yeah, I just don't get that. I thought melamine was just something you made dishes and bowls out of.
Me too.
Stuff.
It was new to me.
Yeah.
It actually makes the rice or wheat read as if it has a higher protein value.
Okay. Hmm.
It's a chemically bad filler.
Interesting. One little thing that you might find of interest, and this is something that Sharon has posted to CTD, various historical events that have taken place in the month of April. April 14th, 1865, Abe Lincoln was shot. April 18th, 1906, the San Francisco earthquake. April 14th, 1912, the Titanic sinks. April 24th, 1915, the beginning of the Armenian Genocide. Do a Google on that if you've not heard of it. It's horrific. April 9th, 1942, the beginning of the Bataan Death March. April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot. April 3rd, 1974, the super tornado outbreak, 148 tornadoes in 13 states. April 4th, 1975. 13 states.
That's why I wanted to make sure that got in there.
April 4th, 1975.
And 148, that adds up to 13 as well.
Yeah. A Vietnamese Operation Babylift plane crashes. That was 1975. April 26th of 1986, Chernobyl melts down. April 29th of 92, the L.A. riots following the Rodney King verdict. April 19th, 1993, Waco. April 6th, 1994, beginning of the Rwanda genocide. Was it cut down the tall trees?
Yeah, it was triggered? Radio. It was another one of those precipitant events that, and there were no guns involved.
No.
That was done with machetes.
Oh, I can't even imagine the... April 19th...
Watch Hotel Rwanda.
Yeah. April 19th, 1995, the bombing of the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. April 28th, 1996, the Port Arthur Massacre. Not well known in the U.S., but very... very fresh memory in Australia. 36 people were killed there. April 20th of 1999, Columbine. And, of course, April 16th of this year, the Virginia Tech Massacre. And the April 20th, of course, also the anniversary of the birth of Adolf Hitler, a.k.a. Adolf Schicklgruber.
Yeah, of course, we did have the NASA shooting on April 20th,
and April
last 20th. Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of things take place in April. I don't know what's going on with that month. But
one of the other things that happened this week here in Columbia, Missouri, that was an aftershock almost, is the way it felt.
It did feel that way. First of all, from the time that the event happened in Blacksburg, Virginia, ripples went throughout the United States education system.
Oh, schools
and
were
buildings
on lockdown.
Everywhere were going on lockdown.
Well, I lost count. It was every day.
Oh, just a fraction.
Yeah.
It would have been nothing but stories about that because dozens and dozens a day were happening.
Yeah, it was bizarre. It was really bizarre. Then on Wednesday at the radio station, we got word from our sister station down in Jefferson City. The afternoon host there gave me a phone call. His daughter called him from a building at the MU campus here in Columbia, saying that they were under lockdown because of a shooting that had taken place on campus. We immediately called the Columbia PD and found out that the shooting was not on the MU campus, but in fact had taken place, well, very close to the bunker here.
Very close to the bunker.
Yeah, about half a mile, and which is only about half a mile away from the radio station, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that the victim had been a passenger in a vehicle, two cars on a street, in a rather nice neighborhood in Columbia.
Oh, a very nice neighborhood.
Yeah, had exchanged gunfire at about 10 minutes before 3 Central Time in the afternoon. The victim, the driver of the car in which the victim was riding, was stopped by police about 3 miles away as he was headed toward the University Hospital. He did not survive. The young man was 17 years old. The shooter was 17 years old. The drivers of both vehicles were 20 years old. The driver of the vehicle from which the shooting, from which the shooter was riding, has been arrested 60 times, 60 times in his young life. And the 17-year-old who pulled the trigger, allegedly, had been out of jail for less than 90 minutes. He had spent the previous 6 days in jail for driving with suspended license. Less than 90 minutes after being released from the Boone County Jail, this young man was firing into another vehicle in the middle of the day on the streets of Columbia, Missouri.
They were using automatic weapons and just shooting at each other like they're in a movie or something.
Right. 4 schools here were locked down. 1 high school, 2 elementary schools, and a middle school. University of Missouri was locked down for just a little while. Just an unbelievable story. This was the first murder of the year in Columbia, Missouri. So you know that this is not something that happens here very often. The fact that it occurred between 2 17-year-olds and 2 20-year-olds out on the street, between 2 vehicles as they're driving along, it was just stunning. And what's even more unbelievable is that the young man had been out of jail for less than 90 minutes and managed to get a gun into his hand.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And what I find interesting, since we were talking earlier about something that happens that sort of triggers an awakening, supernatural battles, and for whatever reason, bleed over into the world that we see and affect people, you know, and you and I and these kids in that. Sorry, I'm stumbling for words. I'm not feeling great today. I'm having a tough time thinking. It's all this, you know, butterfly stuff. No, the night of the shooting here in Columbia, there was a basketball game at which fights broke out, right, not only between the players, but in the stands.
In the stands. And that was bizarre, because that was the high school that had been locked down that afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. This was an exhibition charity game.
Don't know that it was a charity game. It was an exhibition game. There's a team called And One, and they go out and play. They're marketing a new shoe company, I guess, And One, and they're like the And One hip-hop, you know, crew or something. They're supposed to be like a hip-hop version of the Harlem Globetrotters. You know, they don't do Sweet Georgia Brown anymore. It's now, you know, something. And they've got their own MC who raps and stuff at the halftime or whatever. And they played a team of former basketball players from the University of Missouri, Hickman High School, Rockbridge High School, and Columbia College here in town. And apparently the Columbia boys were giving these, you know, national guys more of a game than they expected. And it got rough. And there was a scuffle between the players before halftime. And then with about a minute and a half left in the game, and the national guys only ahead by 5 points. You know, the Columbia boys weren't going to play the Washington Generals, you know. They were giving them a tough time.
Mm-hmm.
The MC for this traveling team got on his microphone and started abusing the referees. And the referees stopped the game and basically said, look, we're trying to call a fair game here. Knock it off. And the guy kept on for like 5 minutes, and then fights started breaking out in the stands. And the principal for Rockbridge High School had to call it a night. Now, I talked with the sports guy, the young man that hosts the afternoon sports talk show on our sister station right next door while I'm on the air in the afternoon. And he said that he had a call from somebody, an adult, who called in and said, my family and I went to this game. My kids wanted to go. They dragged us along. We left at halftime because I was afraid. The sense that I was getting from the crowd was that something bad was going to happen, so we left.
Hmm.
And it just makes you wonder, what is going on? It just felt like something in the air that day
had poisoned
the town.
It did. It was really, really weird.
It was really strange.
Well, let's take a total left turn.
Let us do.
Saudi Arabia.
We've only spent 42 minutes on this.
42, right? Saudi Arabia is going to be the great and grateful recipient of JDAMs, courtesy of the U.S. administration.
Oh, that's great. Those were smart bombs. Those were the bombs that did such a great job in the Gulf Wars. We followed all of them right into the buildings here in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Joint Direct Attack Munition Bombs, JDAM bombs, made by Boeing.
Based now in St. Louis. Yep.
Yep, they're going to be finding their way over to Saudi Arabia. I was shocked when I saw that story.
Yeah.
Bob Gates, who's telling Iraq, you know, clean up your act. Is this a threat to them, or is it a nod and a wink? I don't know what this is.
Needless to say, the government of Ehud Olmert in Israel was not happy about this.
Oh, not at all.
They voiced their protest to the U.S., but the U.S. government basically said, well, you know, if we don't sell them to Saudi Arabia, they'll just buy them from Europe or Russia, so
yeah.
We
might as well be the ones making money on it. I mean, so we can keep an eye on it.
That's right. What's interesting is that John Loftus, who is a fairly regular guest with Dave Emery on his For the Record show, has written a book some years back we need to read called The Secret War Against the Jews. And his, as he's explained it, if I understand it correctly, his belief is that the unspoken policy inside the U.S. military intelligence or MI complex, military industrial complex, is that the Arabs are supposed to win, ultimately, in the Middle East. The Arabs are supposed to win, because they've got the oil, and the Israelis don't.
Have you ever seen footage of George Bush with a Saudi prince?
Mm-hmm.
They're holding hands.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the culture there. But,
I know it's the culture, but I mean, that just seems like, even though it's the culture, I'm not making any kind of a statement about sexuality here. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, it really seems to be that the Saudi family is way too close to the American administration and has been since the George Senior days.
Mm-hmm.
They have helped to, you know, they've been involved in a lot of joint ventures.
Yep, and that is, I think, a disturbing and a rather surprising development for the conservative Christians who supported the administration because they believed that the Republican Party would be a better friend to Israel than the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the people who equate the nation state of Israel with God's chosen people, which mm-hmm. we think is a mistake, but we do believe that Israel has a right to exist and to defend itself.
Absolutely.
And we have to note that the Saudi government has been financing these Wahhabist schools that are teaching radical Islam, not just in the Middle East, but here in the United States, mm-hmm. recruiting among the American prison population. So we've got that going on. And at the same time, with our military commitments in the Middle East, we've got the Air Force being required to do convoy duty now in Iraq because we don't have enough Army soldiers
Isn't
to accompany the trucks on their journeys to
Iraq.
Air
Force personnel training to do Army duty.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's not... Let's not say one's elitist and one's not. Let's not even go there.
No.
But that's not what they were trained to do. That's mm-hmm. not the field they're in. And it's, I think what it says is that if we're going to continue at this pace, the fact is a draft is going to have to come out from Washington at some point.
Right.
And every year, Charlie Rangel
mm-hmm.
drafts legislation for a draft bill.
I think they're just, you know, dragging it out so that, you know, by the time they, until there comes a point where Charlie Rangel doesn't have any voice left and he can't propose the bill again.
That could be.
Every year his voice is rougher and rougher.
Oh, I know.
You know, there are some other interesting things that we need to talk about here. Russia is proposing a, and this is important because this is something that was originally proposed by Reverend Sun Myung-moon.
He's very much still involved in it.
Russia is planning to build the world's longest tunnel to connect Siberia to Alaska, through which trucks, cars, and, pipelines bearing oil and gas, natural gas, from Siberia to mm-hmm. the U.S. can be run.
The King of Peace Tunnel, that's what Sun Myung-moon calls it.
Uh-huh.
And it is, I suppose if you need to bring gas and other products over, that having more direct route over the Bering Strait makes sense. But if you want to invade mm-hmm. the United States through Alaska.
Yeah. Well, that's not a really good way to do it.
I suppose.
Yeah, a couple of well-placed bombs and you close off the access.
Well, that's a good point.
But it would be a 64-mile tunnel, which is twice as long as the channel underneath the mm-hmm. English Channel. So it would be the longest tunnel in the world. I imagine this is going to be an engineering nightmare. I have, you know, a little bit of interest in what they did in Boston there with the Central Artery Tunnel.
Yeah.
Because I supplied steel pipe to the contractor that was responsible for doing the digging in there. They use these pipes just to hold it up on a temporary basis while they finish the excavation. And, you know, see what a mess that's been. Leaks and things popping loose and people getting hurt in there. Can you just imagine a 64-mile long tunnel?
That's
underneath
huge.
The Bering Strait, that is, yeah.
It's huge. Well, Sun Myung-moon is in favor of it because he says it's a way of uniting the world.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to see one big, happy family of man.
Yeah. Well, we'll see where that goes. The this would be part of a whole, about a 6,000-kilometer or 3,700-mile project to bring oil and gas from Siberia to the U.S. And, boy, you know, that's the way we're going to wean ourselves off of that Mideast oil. We'll get it from Russia instead.
You know, speaking, I'm glad you talked about oil because down in Venezuela, I think last Sunday we referred to this, that Chavez had decided to nationalize about 60% of the Orinoco. Is that mm-hmm. what it's called?
Orinoco River Basin.
Yeah. Well, this week there are stories coming out that he's giving boodles and boodles of money to local citizens in Venezuela. He's trying to start up, I had to bring up the story. He's trying to start up local sort of grassroots action committees or whatever, whatever you want to call it. I'm stumbling because I don't have the story in front of me. He says the United States is about to invade Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to really stop that is to start it at the citizen level. And so in your neighborhoods, he's giving money to clean up houses and essentially set up little spy stations. I don't know what else to call it. If you do not toe the Chavez line, you don't get the funding is what it boils down to, because people that do not espouse his politics are finding that there are stumbling blocks to getting the money from Chavez. He supposedly is going to give it to anybody, any neighborhood group that gets together, but that's not what's happening. Now, in the meanwhile, the United States has released Carlos... Carlos Posada Carillas, who was responsible for downing a Cuban jetliner. And he also was an activist in Venezuela. Very dangerous. We're talking about a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
And Chavez is convinced that the reason we released him is for Posada Carillas, to gather some of his network together to assassinate Chavez.
Hmm. That is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What if he's just a patsy?
I don't know. I'd say that's entirely possible.
Mm-hmm. He blew up a Cuban airliner in 1976, which killed 73 people. Been released on bail from a Texas jail.
Mm-hmm.
So
it makes no sense.
Yeah.
He's been in custody for a while now, and all of a sudden, oh, well, you know what? No reason to keep you. Go home.
Yeah. Well, needless to say, Cuba's a little irate. They want him either prosecuted here in the U.S. or extradited to Venezuela.
Well, if he's been released...
That's right. No, they don't want him extradited to Venezuela. That would be...
Actually, I saw a story where they're asking for him to be extradited because they would like to prosecute him down there.
That's true.
And
they are demanding
Castro
one or the other.
Castro was really mad about it.
Yeah.
Castro was very much teased. He wrote a big op-ed piece.
And, you know, you can understand why he might be.
Yes.
Imagine if the situation were reversed.
Imagine somebody held in
a Cuban jail who had been accused of bringing down an American jetliner with 73 people suddenly being released.
Exactly.
On bail.
Exactly.
Yeah. Saying, okay, you know, this doesn't bother us at all. You can go walk around free. That certainly would raise some hackles here in the United States. What else can we pack into this?
This has been such a week. We also had, of course, yesterday, one of the members, playing six, oddly enough, of the Blue Angels team.
Oh, yes.
A young man is now dead, sadly, because his plane crashed. You know, it's just almost like things. I've always heard bad things happen in threes. And if you want to think of Virginia Tech as one, the NASA event is the second one, and the Blue Angel event is the third. I'm not really sure that you can tie them together about like that. But it was very difficult because I think I know that there are a lot of kids and people my age, even maybe I'm a kid, who have watched the Blue Angels for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And these young men have to be crack pilots. They go on a 2-year assignment to the Blue Angels, and from what I've read, this young man was doing his first exhibition.
That's I'm amazed with the type of flying that they do that we've not heard more stories of accidents among Blue Angel pilots over the
mm-hmm.
years.
Yeah, I think the most recent one was in 99, so it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
They do a lot of these air shows.
Yeah. It is not a job that I don't want to have to be that brave when I go to work every day. So our prayers with the family, the young man, and for the members of the team, because this is a difficult thing to come back from. Although I know a guy who flew F-18s, and I can tell you that they've all got an attitude that they are nigh invincible, and you kind of have to have that kind of an attitude when you get behind the stick of one of those planes.
So the movie Top Gun was pretty accurate?
From what little I saw of, these guys, it's pretty accurate. But you have to be that way. If you start thinking, gee, I might die when I go up today behind, you know, I could be really badly hurt, you'd be paralyzed. And those guys can't afford to be paralyzed with fear. They need to be fearless. And so we are thankful that there are some men and women out there who are like that and who are willing to, be that committed for what they believe in.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
One more thing before we go. This is just a little mystery coming to us out of Australia.
Mm.
There is a ghost ship. And by that I mean a ship that appears to have been abandoned. If you've ever read the story or heard the story of the Mary Celeste, this story reminded me very much of that. The Mary Celeste was discovered in the 19th century, I think, late 19th century. The crew was totally gone. It was a man and his family. And they were all gone. The supper was on the table. It looked as if they had just vanished. And there have been some solutions, so-called solutions to that, but the question still remains today, what really did happen? There's no definitive cause. Well, what happened to this schooner, this yacht that was sailing off the Great Barrier Reef? Catamaran was found, no crew on board. Laptop open, still running. The battery hadn't run down. There was food on the table. The dinghy was still on board.
Yeah.
No sign of any kind of violence on board. The only thing that they discovered that was one of the sails was tattered.
Hmm. Very bizarre. Very bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we'll be following because it's just a puzzle. It's almost a locked room mystery in a sense that you don't have any clues that lead you to any obvious guesses
right.
as to what...
The radio was working as well.
I mean,
it isn't as if they realized that they were in trouble and, you know, flagged someone down and said, please let us get on board and we'll radio from your... No. There just seems to be a total mystery. The authorities got on board, said the engine was running, the computers were running, there was a laptop set up on the table which was running, the radio was working, there was food and utensils set up on the table ready to eat, but no sign of the crew.
Yep. Three men disappeared, the dinghy still on board, and no other evidence as to what might have happened. So we'll just kind of wait to see what forensics turns up on that. Well, we're hoping that next week we can be a little more cheerful. This is kind of a somber week.
I know.
And,
I'd like to end with Philippians 4:8, which I put on the site, and I think I may have mentioned this last week. I put it on the site to encourage me. When I go to CTD and I'm posting stories that are really genuinely depressing and will bring you down, and peering into darkness is what we do. So Philippians 4:8 came to mind last week, and I've really just been, you know, claiming it every day. Finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. Let's
Amen.
Think about the good things and praise God for them.
Email radio@peeringintodarkness.com, and you can always join us at the forum at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
That'll do it.
Show notes at pidradio.com, and until next week, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everybody.
This is PID Radio.
Catherine Adamson thought she was going back to her quiet hometown of Eden, Indiana, to settle the affairs of her late Aunt Celeste. Instead, she discovers that Eden has literally gone to hell. Two high school students have disappeared, leaving behind only a running car and a bloody shoe. Strange lights have appeared over the town, and the fields of a local farm are marked with blackened circles. Eden County Hospital reports record births, incredibly large babies joining the ranks of a growing number of giants. Many of Eden's leading citizens have been hiding evil secrets, but their behavior has been closely watched by the mysterious Dr. Apollo Bell, head of the Mount Hermon Institute. All of Eden is a war camp, and citizens must choose sides in an eternal battle. Catherine is reunited with her old flame, Joshua Carpenter, the publisher of the Eden Chronicle. They quickly learn their strongest ally may be John Thundercloud, a legless old Winnebago Indian who spends his days writing line after line in a library full of tattered diaries. It's Winds of Evil by Sharon K. Gilbert, book one of the Laodicea Chronicles. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.
They're coming from the darkness. Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return. And at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed. This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.